Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 14, The Good Samaritan. For those of you who haven't read the blog post, the reason this episode is being released a little late is because I found my initial research on Justin Martyr unsatisfactory, and Justin Martyr really deserves the best. So, after a few more days of research and typing, I can finally present the episode I want to. I hope you all enjoy it. Last episode, we left off with the martyrdom of the Apostolic Father, Polycarp, the Bishop of Smyrna. When Polycarp was martyred in 156 AD, a Christian apologist in Rome took this opportunity to write to the Emperor Antoninus Pius and his adopted sons, Marcus Aurelius and Lucius Verus. This man's name was Justin, a Christian philosopher, and arguably the greatest of the second century apologists. Justin was born in the early second century to pagan parents in the city of Flavia Neapolis, near the biblical city of Shechem in Samaria. Although he was from Samaria, Justin came from a pagan family, though he was familiar with local Samaritan culture and even felt comfortable referring to himself as a Samaritan. As a young man, Justin was a seeker of God and truth. He first tried the Stoic school of Greek philosophy, but found it could not offer him an understanding of God's being. The peripatetic teacher was more interested in Justin paying him tuition than teaching him about the divine being. The Pythagorean teacher told Justin he must learn music, astronomy, and geometry before discussing spiritual truths. Finally, Justin came to the Middle Platonists, who were highly interested in God and Plato's teachings concerning him. Therefore, Justin was quite content with Platonism. Around the year 130 AD or so, Justin was taking his usual walk along the seashore when an old man came up to him and started to question Justin's Platonist beliefs. When the old man convinced Justin of Platonism's errors, he told Justin about the Hebrew prophets of the Old Testament, older and wiser than the earliest Greek thinkers. Christian apologists often claim Plato got his ideas from plagiarizing Moses and the prophets. An interesting idea, but no one today actually accepts this anymore. Finally, the old man told him about Jesus Christ. The old man then left Justin with a burning fire in his heart for the love of Christ and his people. Interestingly, Justin was never able to find or identify this mysterious old man. This moment was not the final impetus for Justin's conversion, though. What made him finally receive baptism was witnessing the execution of Christian martyrs. Despite all the slurs pagans railed against them, Justin saw how courageous and heroic the Christians were. It was the martyrs who finally won over the young philosopher. Justin's conversion to Christianity by no means meant his abandonment of philosophy. On the contrary, Justin believed he had found the true philosophy. All the other philosophies still had a kernel of truth, some more than others, but only Christianity held the fullness of the knowledge of God. Thus, Greco-Roman learning was not opposed to the gospel, but rather, Jesus was the completion of what Plato and others had long sought after. Justin traveled far and wide, but one of his permanent residences was in Rome. He set up his own philosophical school where he instructed his students in the true reason of God. His school was not for catechumens, but Christians within the larger Orthodox community in Rome. Justin was not off alone with his students isolated. In fact, he gives in his writings a lovely description of Sunday Eucharistic worship. One of Justin's central ideas was the Logos. The Logos, meaning word, was Christ. There were two components of Justin's Christological idea of the Logos. On the one hand, there was the biblical precedent. The Gospel of John, for example, explicitly referred to Jesus as the Logos of God the Father. This sort of thinking about God had its roots in the two powers idea of Second Temple Judaism. In the Hebrew Bible, there are various instances where God appears in the form of a man, where the Father's word and wisdom are personified. There's the angel of Yahweh and the name of Yahweh. He wrestles with Abraham's grandson, Jacob, and renames him Israel. Sometimes it looks like two persons are identified as the God of Abraham. For instance, Abraham stands before an embodied God, interceding for Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 19. When Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed, the embodied Yahweh on earth rains fire down from Yahweh in heaven. Most dramatically, there was the Son of Man of Daniel 7, who had divine attributes like riding on the clouds, having cosmic dominion, and receiving worship from all the peoples of the earth. The title Son of Man was actually Jesus' favorite self-designation, despite its significance being largely lost on later Christian writers. One could go on and on with examples where it appears in the Old Testament that a secondary figure, word, wisdom, angel of Yahweh, etc., is identified as Israel's God, and yet distinguished from the Father. This was not lost on the Jews during and before the rise of Christianity. Various candidates were put forward as the second power by different Jewish writers. In one sense, then, the Church's identification of Jesus with the Word and wisdom of God was in line with the Judaism of the day. But Christians made innovations with the two powers teaching. One, they worshipped Jesus along with God the Father, and two, they identified God's Word as a man who lived in their own lifetime. This was too much for many Jews. Eventually, the rabbis identified the word more with the books of the Torah and even anathematized the two powers doctrine as heretical. Justin's Logos theology was also influenced by philosophy. In Greek thought, Logos meant reason. When talking about God and the cosmos, it referred to the divine reason which underpinned all creation. Thus, for Justin, God the Father ruled the cosmos as the immutable ruler and fashioner of all, but his Logos was the divine reason who revealed perfectly to mankind the truth of the transcendent Father. In a way, this resembles the demiurge idea of Plato. The supreme being is distant, and it is another, lower God, who interacts with the world. But for Justin, Jesus Christ the Logos was not some creature, but integral to God the Father. He used the analogy of how a candle could pass fire to other candles, but yet the original candle remained just as powerful. Nothing was taken away from it. The Logos did not take away from God's power or uniqueness. He simply replicated it, because Christ was ultimately derived from the Father. Here, Justin is delving into an area of Trinitarian theology which would give Christians a great difficulty in expressing. How does the Church, on the one hand, say that Jesus is truly eternal divinity, and yet at the same time speak of Jesus as having the source of his existence in God the Father? The later phrase, begotten, not made, will eventually be a shorthand to express this idea. In other words, Christ, because he is God's word or wisdom or logos, is in some way derivative of God the Father, and yet he is eternal, uncreated, like God the Father. Or else, if Jesus, the word and wisdom, was a creature, the Father was without speech and stupid in eternity past, which would mean he isn't God. Justin leans in the way of emphasizing the Logos' subordination to God the Father. For instance, he speaks of Jesus coming forth from the Father for the purpose of creation. But before creation, He existed within God until the Father uttered him forth. I could go on and on about every facet of Justin's theology, but we won't get anywhere in the narrative if I do that. Justin's school in Rome met above the baths of Mertinus, a place still unidentified in Rome. Of his pupils, two are worthy of mention. The first was from Asia Minor, Miltiades, about whom we know little, and none of his work survives. However, he will show up again in our story, so I figured I'd better introduce him. The more famous student of Justin's was Tatian. Tatian was an Assyrian by birth, which means he resided in the borderlands lying between the Roman and Parthian empires, and within the kingdom of Osroene, mentioned back in episode 6. Tatian's background was foreign to Greco-Roman culture, and so, unlike his teacher, who held great appreciation for Hellenic philosophy, Tatian leaned more towards a very low estimation of the Greek pagan world around him. I will discuss Tatian in detail in a future episode, because I want to keep today's focus on Justin. Of Justin's three major works which have survived, the earliest is likely his dialogue with Trypho. The dialogue purports to relate a debate Justin had in Ephesus with a Hellenistic Jew named Trypho, who had recently fled from the devastation of the Bar Kokhba War. Who was this Trypho? Was there even a Trypho? Did a debate even actually take place? The traditional position has been that there was indeed a real debate, and that Trypho is to be identified with the fiercely anti-Christian rabbi Tarpon. You may remember him from episode 10. However, all this seems unlikely. For one, Trypho is very cordial to Justin and does not behave in accord with what we know about Rabbi Tarpon. Second, the dialogue is clearly a literary piece and seems too scripted to be a simple transcript of a debate. So that leaves us with two options. One, the debate is wholly fictitious, merely an apologetic story crafted by Justin. Or two, the dialogue with Trypho is based around a debate Justin had with a real Jew by that name, but has been fleshed out and colored for apologetic purposes. In all honesty, neither I, nor the scholars I have read, seem to be able to agree on which of the two options is most probable. Supposedly, Justin was in Ephesus when he was approached by Trypho, who came over to him eagerly, seeing that Justin was a philosopher. Justin wore a philosopher's robe. Trypho, being a very keen intellectual, was delighted to meet Justin and discuss God and philosophical truth with him, given their mutual appreciation for Greek thought. But when Trypho asked Justin what his philosophy was, and Justin answered with the story of his conversion to Christianity, Trypho was taken aback and told Justin that he had been deceived. For Trypho, there were two paths to God. One was Greek philosophy, and the other Judaism, following the Mosaic Law. And so, a lengthy and passionate, yet still friendly, debate ensued between the two. And I do mean lengthy. The dialogue is by far the longest of Justin's works. In the dialogue, Justin repeatedly attempts to show how the Old Testament scriptures predicted Christ's coming, death, resurrection, the establishment of the church, and the calling of the Gentiles to God's new and final covenant. He likely had access to a list of proof texts and respective exegesis Christians used from the Septuagint. While he upheld the Torah's moral demands, Justin says the ceremonial and ritualistic parts of Moses need to be interpreted spiritually, as pointing forward to Jesus. At one point, Trypho asks Justin a very interesting question. If someone believes in Jesus and the gospel, can he or she still keep the law, or does this harm their salvation? The question was particularly poignant when it came to Jewish Christians. Justin responded by saying, so long as said person did not force others to do so, following the Torah was fine. It seems possible Justin had contacts with the Nazarenes we discussed in episode 10. However, Justin also states that some other Christians are of a different opinion and condemn continual observance of the Torah. Justin's next major work was directed not to Jews, but Roman pagans. As mentioned earlier, he was prompted to write an apology to Emperor Antoninus Pius, his adopted sons and heirs, Marcus and Lucius, and the entire Roman Senate, most likely because of the recent martyrdom of Polycarp in Smyrna. Thus, like Quadratus and Aristides before him, Justin continued along in the tradition of writing defenses of the faith directly to the Augustus himself. Justin, like many of the other second century apologists, was not a bishop or born from a Christian family. The apologists were often men from pagan backgrounds, who took the skills they inherited in philosophy and other areas and used them to explain the Christian faith to the Greco-Roman world in terms it could understand. Thus, the apologists were different from the earlier apostolic fathers, who wrote mainly for Christians. Justin's first apology opens with a cry for justice. He compares the Christian martyrs to Socrates. An interesting tactic. Socrates was executed in ancient Greece because he was accused of preaching foreign gods, the same charges Paul was accused of in Athens a half a millennium later. Socrates saw through the folly of Zeus and the Olympians, and so the demons, the same demons who would later instigate the Jews against Christ and the church, also had instigated the Athenians to kill Socrates, and now they were manipulating the Romans to martyr Christians. These demons were, according to Justin, the unclean offspring of fallen angels and human women, based on the passage from Genesis 6 talking about the sons of God coming down and having giant children with mortal women. This interpretation of Genesis 6 is an interesting tangent we will save for another day. Suffice it to say, the early church understood it in accordance with traditions of the non-canonical Jewish books of Enoch. The point about demons also illustrates another aspect of early Christian thinking. Following the Apostle Paul, the martyrs saw the real enemy, not as the Romans, but as Satan and his minions. The devil was using the pagan torturers to lead Christians to apostasy. Justin also rebuts the three charges pagans constantly hurled against Christians: atheism, immorality, and disloyalty to the empire. While Justin conceded that, yes, Christians were atheists as regards to Jupiter and his colleagues, they were not real atheists in the true sense of the word, for Christians worshipped God the Father, the God Plato and the other philosophers sought communion with. Christians worshipped God's Logos, Jesus Christ, and his Spirit, the Spirit of prophecy, who spoke by the prophets that foretold the life of the Savior. Christians were not immoral, in fact, quite the opposite. Christians held to a very stringent form of morality that many conservative Roman elites would have nodded their heads to. Justin does say that if Christians did commit any real crimes, they would willingly be punished for their acts. He also dispels fears of disloyalty and rebellion by appealing to the heavenly nature of Christ's kingdom, the same thing that dissuaded Domitian from persecuting Jesus' relatives 60 years earlier. The remainder of the Apology is largely polemic against paganism and heresy, demonstrating the superiority of the Orthodox faith. How the true worship of the Logos predates all other faiths, and that Plato plagiarized Moses. At the end, Justin attaches the rescript of Hadrian sent to the proconsul of Asia that prevented mobs from clamoring against Christians and providing poorly evidenced accusations. Obviously, the martyrdom of Polycarp was a clear violation of Hadrian's law. Christians, as we have seen in earlier episodes, were persecuted for the name, not any actual crimes. If the accused simply sacrificed and cursed Christ, he or she was set free. If there was a real crime, Justin pointed out, they would still be punished. A murderer would not be set free simply because he was not a murderer anymore. Thus, executing Christians just for the name of being Christians implicitly meant there was no crime. Justin vigorously protested the Roman policy and believed such injustice was not befitting of Antonine Rome. The occasion for Justin's so-called second apology was also martyrdom. A Roman woman who had once lived a promiscuous life was now a catechumen in the church under the guidance of a certain Ptolemy. The woman's pagan husband also lived a life of adultery, and she tried to persuade him to embrace the way of Christ, but he adamantly refused. He continued to live his wicked life, and it became emotionally unbearable for his wife. So she gave him a bill of divorce. Now, one would think this would please her husband, since now he was free to fornicate without the thought of his wife hanging over him. But it had the opposite effect. The cheating husband accused his estranged wife of being a Christian. The woman then petitioned Emperor Antoninus to allow her to set her affairs in order and then face her accusation. The wise and benevolent Antoninus permitted her request, but her husband would not give up. So he accused her catechist Ptolemy of Christianity before the urban prefect, Quintus Lollius Urbicus. You may remember Urbicus as the long-serving governor of Britannia from episode 85 of the History of Rome. Urbicus was persuaded to prosecute Ptolemy based on a confession of Christianity Ptolemy had given when a centurion was persuaded by the adulterous husband to imprison the teacher and interrogate him. Ptolemy readily confessed his faith and was then bound and subjected to various tortures before being led before the urban prefect. Urbicus asked Ptolemy if he was a Christian, and Ptolemy, once again, said yes. And so, the prefect ordered him to be executed. Two other men nearby, a certain Lucius and the other unnamed, objected to this miscarriage of justice. Urbicus then had them both executed too, after they confessed Christianity. While the empire was not actively persecuting Christians from the top down, the story of Ptolemy and Lucius is a reminder of the daily fear early Christians lived in, that their pagan and Jewish neighbors could turn them into the authorities at any moment. When Justin heard about this, he wrote again to Antoninus and the Senate. Many typical features of Justin's apologetic reappear in this shorter work. Justin again connects violence against Christians with the pagan gods, and connects them with the fallen angels and demons of Genesis 6. Following Enochic traditions, Justin says these beings are the source of occultism and sacrifice. These demons deceived the classical authors of ancient Greece into worshipping them and calling them by names such as Neptune and Pluto. He invokes the example of Socrates and other martyred philosophers too. He also states how God withholds his judgment from the world, inhabited by evil angels and sinful men, for the sake of preserving Christians. Justin also invokes the eternal fire of judgment, as did Polycarp. Quite bold for a man addressing the emperor and senate. The dialogue with Trypho and the two apologies are the only extant works of Justin. Fragments and summations remain of his larger literary output. For instance, he wrote a book against heretics like the Gnostics and Marcionites, which later church fathers would draw upon. It is through Justin, ultimately, that we gather reliable information about the Samaritan Gnostics, Simon Magus and Menander. Justin was familiar with them due to his Samaritan background. Like Ptolemy and Lucius, Justin himself was worried he too would soon be turned in, perhaps by a certain man named Crescens, a self-acclaimed Cynic philosopher. Crescens had a habit of denouncing Christians in public and spreading all kinds of ridiculous slanders about them. Justin claims that he was abhorrently ignorant of Christianity, having never even read, let alone studied, Christian writings. As many of you may already be able to tell, given the fact that we call Justin Martyr, his story is going to have a violent, bloody end. And it was Crescens, no less, who brought it about. Around 165 AD, Justin engaged in a philosophical debate with Crescens, and apparently defeated him. Enraged, Crescens, being the anti-Christian bigot that he was, reported Justin to the prefect of Rome, Quintus Junius Rusticus, the famed teacher of Emperor Marcus Aurelius. Although Tatian managed to escape, Justin and six of his students were brought and tried before the urban prefect. Rusticus questioned Justin about his faith, and then tried to get the apologist to reveal the location of other Christian assemblies in Rome. But Justin's reply was reticent. Finally, the prefect warned them all that if they did not renounce Christianity, they would be beheaded for breaking the laws of Rome. But Justin and his companions all remained steadfast and looked forward to their salvation. And so, Justin and six of his students were martyred under Junius Rusticus around 165 AD in the reign of Marcus Aurelius. Justin was about in his 60s and had been defending and teaching the faith for about 30 years. Despite all his work to engage the classical world, in the end, it chose to kill him anyway. The remainder of the 2nd century will see similar patterns. Despite the sincere apologetics of faithful Christians, persecution will remain a real possibility, even in the era of the five good emperors. Next episode, we will push forward through the 160s and 170s AD and see the church facing against pagan persecution, as well as a new prophetic movement, which will confound the church to either embrace or reject it. As always, thank you for listening. Please comment, review, and subscribe. Your input is extremely valued and very encouraging to me. I read every comment. If I don't respond on the blog site, I will certainly respond in the podcast itself. Please keep the feedback coming. Be sure to like the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, and invite anyone you think would be interested in the History of the Early Church podcast. If you have thoughts or questions about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com, and don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.